Fine. Do you guys mind if I sit down here? Is that about? Is that okay?
It's
all right.
Do you want us? You
it is picturesque. You fit right in with the background there.
Well, there's a camera.
And that's important.
This would be a good day to take the picture.
No, it wouldn't. In the early part of the 20th century, when scholars first began trying to understand what was going on in Tibet with the religion there, they coined a term which is no longer used by scholars but was quite prevalent at the time, called Lamaism. They didn't say that what was being practiced in Tibet was Buddhism. They said it was Lamaism. And the reason they said it was Lamaism, they also called the monasteries Lamaseries, curiously. Right? The reason they said that was because they noticed that all the monks seemed to be worshiping the teachers, the lamas. And besides which, they saw all this other stuff that was going on that didn't look very Buddhist to them, because they were often very highly influenced by missionaries, or they were missionaries, and they had a very definite Christian view of reality. So they didn't think that what was going on in Tibet was Buddhism, and they called it Lamaism. In a certain sense, they weren't totally off base, because the relationship of the students to the lamas, or the students to the teachers, was very important, was considered very important. But they didn't have a very deep understanding of what was actually going on. They actually had about as superficial an understanding of what was actually going on as is imaginable. Now, for one thing, if you've taken any of the higher practices, like the Yamataka practice, but in fact most of the tantric practices, one of the things you're supposed to do is you're supposed to do a six-session guru yoga. You're supposed to do this six times. You're supposed to do guru yoga. Recite the guru yoga sadhana, or practice, six times a day. So no wonder scholars looked at this and said, you know, especially when you look at what's going on in the guru yoga, they said they're worshiping the gurus. And lama and guru are the same thing. I mean, lama is the Tibetan way of saying what the Indians mean by guru. So you can see why they came to that conclusion. In fact, I remember before I really began to understand seriously what this practice was about, I've been practicing Buddhism actually for quite a long time, and Kay and I were at a retreat in Hawaii. It was actually the last retreat we did with our teacher, Tara Tulku. And one of the two people that was hosting the retreat made a comment, which it was just a passing comment toward the end of the retreat, and I didn't really kind of glom onto it in a certain way. It just sort of, he said it, and I thought, oh, okay. And then I went on to other things. He said basically, well, anyway, I don't remember exactly the whole context of what we were talking about. He said, well, anyway, it doesn't matter. It's all about the relationship with the guru. It's all about guru yoga. Nothing else really matters. And then we went on and had another conversation about something else. But obviously it mattered to me, because that was 1989. I think it was 1980. Was it 1989? I think it was 1989. 1990? 1990. Okay, it was 1990. So here it is 21 years later, and I still remember it. So obviously something happened. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about guru yoga and what it really is. And, I mean, the short what it really is that if the teacher is a real teacher, as in is truly qualified to be a teacher, because they have some deep realization that comes out of their own practice, then what they've done is they've really reached a place within themselves where they're expressing their own Buddha nature. So, again, sometimes in the media, even now, you'll hear someone say, well, so-and-so is a living Buddha. Like, they'll talk about the Dalai Lama that way. So the Dalai Lama is a living Buddha. And mostly the journalists who write such things don't have a clue what they're talking about, but it sounds good. But actually, as it turns out, they're kind of correct, but they don't actually know they're correct. They don't know why they're correct. You know, that happens often enough. But they are kind of right, because a real teacher, a real lama, actually is somebody who has made a deep investigation of themselves over many years and has actually, if you will, excavated or released or realized their own Buddha nature, which is the point of all of this stuff, because everybody is potentially a Buddha, and the whole point of practicing is to bring that forth and to live that way. So why would you want to have a teacher who wasn't somebody who had already done that? Because that's where you want to go. I mean, if you wanted to study nuclear physics, you wouldn't be in the biology department. You certainly wouldn't be in the literature department. You would be in the nuclear physics department, because those would be the people who knew the thing, right? So if you wanted to become a Buddha, and there isn't any other reason to practice Buddhism, if you wanted to become a Buddha, then if you could, you'd want to find a teacher who was as close to being a Buddha as you could possibly find. Now, that's not necessarily easy. If you live in the Grand, you've got me. And that's not very close to being a Buddha, but, you know, better than nothing. Better than nothing, not very close, but better than nothing. If you live in Dharamsala, you know, if you can spend any time with him, you've got the Dalai Lama. That's, I don't know, maybe he's a Buddha, maybe he's not. I'm not close enough to know where he's at, and I won't, you know, venture any thought on that particular subject, except wherever he's at, it's someplace pretty amazing, so that's good enough for me. So that's the point. And so, you know, I mean, so the Tibetans understood this. I mean, so, okay, you want to find a teacher who has traversed the path. I mean, they know the road. Sort of like if you want to get to New York, you don't ask somebody who knows the road between Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro. You ask a truck driver who knows the road between La Grande and New York, because you don't want to go to Rio de Janeiro. You want to go to New York. So you ask somebody who knows that route. So that's basically who you want to look for in a teacher. You want somebody who knows that path, who knows that route, which means they got there. Now, that's hard to find. I mean, there are people around who presumably got there, but they're not all over the place. So that's why we read books, because we can read things that were left behind by people who've done that sort of thing. So if we want to find our own Buddha natures within ourselves, we don't have a clue what that Buddha nature looks like. We really don't. I mean, if we knew what it looked like, we'd be there, right? But we're not there. And we've mostly probably never been there, even though it's in us. We don't really know what it's like. So it doesn't do a whole lot of good to say, well, I have a Buddha nature within myself. I'll just pay attention to what's going on in here, and that'll be okay. Because the problem with that is there's so much going on in here, and a lot of it is the stuff that's covering over the Buddha nature, bad habits, and so on and so forth, and we can get really confused. So that doesn't work too well. I mean, there was a period of time when people would say, I'll just be my own guru. That works really well. Well, if you've never been to New York and you just say, well, it's over that way someplace, you might end up in Phoenix. Well, Phoenix is okay, but it's still not New York, right? So that doesn't work real well. So there's a logic to why, you know, you would have this relationship with somebody who has gotten there. And, of course, there is a pretty special place. I mean, and they're not just ordinary people, right? So, you know, what kind of relationship would you have with them? Well, you know, if it's devoted, if it's worshipful, why would that be a surprise? I mean, you know, toward the end of the day yesterday, we were talking about what we've been doing, and, you know, Kay had been doing her thing, and I'd been sort of sitting on the side as the ritual assistant, but I'd definitely been doing my thing. And I said toward the end of the day, I'd been meditating on the presence of our gurus in the room, and I'd felt them. I felt that they were here. And Kay started crying because she was so open at that particular point that when her mind was directed to that, and that she'd been really in her own way experiencing that, and she reflected on that, and she reflected on how much she missed them because of her devotion to them, she started crying. And that's actually considered a good thing. Atisha, who was one of the great transmitters of Buddhism to Tibet in the middle of the 11th century, he actually died in Lhasa in 1054, who was responsible for this whole transmission of the mode of teaching that I teach, because his lineage went down through the Tsongkhapa and all the Dalai Lamas, and so that's where my main connection is. So I feel like, you know, he's in my lineage of teachers. Was one of the abbots of Nalanda Monastic University. I mean, this was one of the great establishments of Asia. It was like the equivalent of the Library of Alexandria before it was burned, except it was even vaster. And he was an abbot of this monastic university that had thousands of students, and he was highly revered and everything else. And yet, he went to Indonesia he went to Java for 12 years to study with a master in Java who knew and had realized bodhicitta most deeply, universal altruism most deeply. So, you know, he left Nalanda, and it wasn't exactly an easy thing to do to get from sort of the Gangetic plain of India, lower Gangetic plain of India, to Java. It was a long way, a hard journey, and so on and so forth. But he did. He spent 12 years in Java, then he came back to Nalanda. And it's said that when he was teaching, if he ever even mentioned his master's name, he burst into tears to remember him. Now, this is this great abbot of a monastery sitting on a throne teaching thousands of students, tears coming out of his eyes when he mentions his own teacher. Okay. This is real guru devotion. And why? Because from his point of view, he understood, he experienced that his teacher had realized that deepest quality in himself. And because of his own advancement, he realized how profound that understanding was that his teacher had, and it brought tears to his eyes. This is a good thing. This is this deep devotion. But where does this devotion get you? How do you develop it? How do you get to it? Well, you actually can practice it. It's like anything else. You actually can practice it. So the whole point of guru yoga is to rehearse or practice your relationship with this other person who is, if you will, the living symbol of your own Buddha nature, which you can't see, but you can see them. So here's this living being that has all this great realization, who you can see, who you can know, who you can talk to, who you can have a relationship with, who's a stand-in for the Buddha nature within yourself that's much harder to know because you're so disconnected from it. Right? So what the sixth session guru yoga is about finding yourself by cultivating the relationship with somebody who's found themselves. And it works because their deepest nature is completely identical with your deepest nature. Because the Buddha in them and the Buddha in you are no different. In their essence, in their fundamental nature, they're the same. So, if you can relate to it outside and practice that relationship, then you can practice that relationship with it inside. So it starts with outside, and then it moves to inside. Now, that's both from the point of view of time, which is, you know, you develop a relationship with a teacher and you practice for 20 years, and 20 years of practice, you actually develop a relationship with your inner self. That part of yourself, which you, at first you can only see outside, then you can see inside. But you also practice it when you practice it, which is to say, if you look at the way Guru Yoga works, it works like all of the sadhanas, like the green Tara, the Vajrasattva, the Amantaka. There are certain features that are the same in all of these practices. And one of the features that's the same is you begin by visualizing or imagining the presence of the Vajrasattva or the green Tara or the Amantaka or the Guru in front of yourself. And you firmly establish a relationship with that visualized image of the person you remember. It's sort of like if you love your spouse and you're away on a business trip, and you think about, oh, I miss my wife so much, you know, and then you see her image, and then you think about how much you love her, and then all that emotion comes up. It's sort of like, oh, I can feel her almost. It's like she's almost here with me, you know. Like you can have that kind of reverie. So it's like having that kind of relationship with that visualized image of the teacher who's really your own Buddha nature, which you see in front of yourself. And then in the practice, the next thing that happens is you visualize the teacher or the deity, whatever the case may be, coming to the top of your head and then merging with you. So, I mean, you're working with a symbolic mind when you're doing this, but you're starting off with, there's my Buddha nature outside of myself, and now I imagine that Buddha nature within myself, and in the very beginning it feels like it's other than me, but it's me, and we're cohabiting the same space, and somehow we have some kind of relationship with each other, and you hang out in that space long enough, and they merge. And then you get into, oh, the Buddha nature of my teacher within myself, the Buddha nature of myself within myself, they're the same thing, and there it is. And if you actually cultivated a relationship with that person, and then you feel that person within yourself, that's a living relationship. So now you're cultivating a living relationship with the Buddha nature within you. It's not an abstraction. It's a real experience. Just as you can really sit in the audience, see the Dalai Lama, hear him, get a feel for his presence, and then you can bring that within yourself, and you can find that within yourself. And you can look through that like a door or a window. You can look through that presence like a door or a window into the essence of what he has realized, which is his own Buddha nature. So it's almost like looking down through a telescope in reverse, if you will, or something like that, where you're looking at an image of a person and remembering that living person and getting a feel for that living person and then looking at what's in that living person, what's the essence of that person that makes them so special. Because if the Dalai Lama hadn't realized his own Buddha nature, right, he would just be a peasant kid from Amdo and nothing special. And how would you have a relationship? Well, I mean, you know, some guy that was born in northeastern Tibet in 1936 with no cars and no electricity and you know, rode around on horses and, like, speaks English weird, you know, looks a little strange, you know. But that's not, you know, but that's not what's going on when you're around him. There's something else that's happening. So now, so the Guru Yoga is a way of practicing this, and it follows the basic practice and the basic principles of any sadhana, including, as I said, the green Tara, which we'll be doing later tonight, or the Yamantaka, if you've taken that up, or the Vajrasattva, or anything else that you're doing. Now, the practice, typically, you're asked to do the succession Guru Yoga, which means do this practice six times a day, which seems like pretty onerous, because if you remember the way that Kay recited it, it takes a long time. But Tibetans are very practical. They always have a short version of something, and then they have a really short version of something, and then they have the incredibly shortest version of something, you know. So the shortest version of something would be, there he is, now he's on my head, now he's inside of me, that's cool, okay, now I'll get on with things. But that's so short that you're probably not going to get anything out of it. But there is a sort of intermediate short, and this is the one that I practice, although this isn't the translation that I use. I was having a hard time tracking it down. But I'll read it to you, and then we can stop and we can talk about some of the things that are in it. And the reason I'm not doing my own is because the way I remember it is I start from one end and I go to the other end. And if you ask me to back up to the fourth line, I don't remember what it is. But in a book, I can look at the fourth line and then, you know, remember what it is. So I was talking about, different translators, and this translation of the short, of the middle-length short, or the short not-so-long, or whatever it is, it's by Jeffrey Hopkins, and it's really an accurate translation, but it's not poetically the most wonderful. And one of the things about translating Tibetan texts is it's very hard to get an elegant translation that's accurate. When somebody pulls it off, they're a genius. They're kind of hard to find, but you can find them. There are a few people around who manage to pull it off. Bob Thurman pulls it off on a relatively regular basis, but as I said, he's a genius, and so he can do that. There are other translators that do a good job. So I'll read this to you, and then if you have questions, you know, we can do some Q&A, if that's okay. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we can do some Q&A about what's in here. And I'll try and track down my own translation for you. I know I have a copy in my office in a drawer for when I can't remember it, but I usually remember it, so that's why I've lost track of all the written out texts, because I do it first thing in the morning when I'm meditating, and then I do it when I'm walking to work. And then I do it at one point during the middle of the day when I'm usually losing my mind at work. I do it on the elliptical walker when I'm working out. I do it when I'm walking home. I mean, you know, because you memorize the text, then it's really easy to do it six times a day. And then the other thing that's really nice is it definitely improves things. You know, so as long as they're not playing super loud rock and roll at Quinn, you know, I can do the guru yoga when I'm doing my time on the elliptical walker. And just from a pragmatic point of view, what I've discovered is that it slows my heart rate down, it makes me less stressed out, and makes it really easy to be on the elliptical walker for a long period of time. Because it's kind of like, you know, my body is doing its thing, and it's kind of mellowed out, because my mind is doing something else, and it's mellowed out. And my mind isn't looking at my body saying, all right, already, you know, what's going on here? When is this going to stop? So on and so forth. It has all kinds of practical ramifications. And I won't even talk about my relationship with the high school students who I walk past when I'm doing guru yoga on the way to work in the morning, which is that's a whole other kind of thing. It really helps, believe me. Okay, so let me have a drink of water here, and then I'll read this to you. And I might make some comments along the way. So, 1, 2, 3, 4. Uh-oh.
Got it.
We okay?
Yeah.
Did we use a glass fish?
No.
Oh, okay, then it doesn't matter. We lost we lost half the tail on that glass fish over there when Kay was dusting, so I don't.
Oh, no.
Well, as long as he's got the other half of the tail, he can still negotiate. Yeah, he can negotiate.
He's attached to his fish.
Yeah, I'm attached to that fish. It's true.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I mean, look at it. It's really a cute fish. I don't mean the big one. I mean the little one. Yeah. The big one's cute, too. I like the little one. All right. So what did I see here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 stanzas. Not hard. From my heart I go for refuge to the three jewels. I will release all sentient beings from pain and set all in final bliss. To do that, I will generate an altruistic intention to attain perfect enlightenment. and thereupon we'll train in the learnings of bodhisattvas. So this is setting the intention and going for refuge. On a throne in space in front of myself, upon discs of sun, moon, and lotus, is my root lama, the pervasive master Vajradhara, blue in color, holding Vajra and bell, embracing Vajraduti Ishvari and sporting with innate bliss. So, lama appears in front of oneself in complete form. Three places of his body are marked by the three letters, which would be Oma Hum. With the light of the letter Hum, the wisdom beings are invited and become one taste with the imagined beings, which is to say, you're rehearsing his own experience of bringing the full lineage into himself, which is his own practice of Guru Yoga. So imagine him practicing Guru Yoga, and his guru practicing Guru Yoga, and that guru practicing Guru Yoga. So they've all come into the teacher. Homage to the lotus feet of Vajradhara. What else would you say to a guru who's a Buddha? I make offerings with oceans of clouds of external, internal, and secret offerings, and with the unsurpassed offerings of Samantabhadra, mountains, lands, vases of jeweled treasures, sun, moon, and so forth. Having seen that all without exception of the supreme and common feats follow upon proper reliance on you, O protector, may I, disregarding even body and life, be blessed to achieve only what is pleasing to you. Which is to say that the teachings of the Lama are what are responsible for everything you ever learn and achieve. Through making petitions, the Lama comes to my crown and, dissolving into me, becomes of one taste with me. We merge. I am Vajrasattva, holding Vajra and bell, and embracing the female supermundane victor's sport with innate bliss, which is to say, you're in relationship with yourself. For the sake of my mothers, I give away without regret. And by the way, every being has been your mother at one time or another because of the teachings of reincarnation, so that's what that means. For the sake of my mothers, I give away without regret my residence, body, resources, and collections of virtue of the past, present, and future. Even if it costs my life, I will not transgress the boundaries formulated for the three vows, individual liberation, bodhisattva, and secret mantra. Having assumed well the doctrine, verbal and realizational, contained within the three vehicles and the four tantra sets, I will thoroughly liberate transmigrators through methods. That means I take on the responsibility to act in the world in a beneficial way. By this virtue, may the wishes made by the ones gone to bliss and the bodhisattvas be accomplished. That means the Buddhas and the bodhisattvas. I dedicate this virtue to the maintenance of the doctrine. Through the ineluctable power of the magnificent blessings of the three jewels and of dependent arising, may my good wishes be accomplished, and I quickly attain Buddhahood. So, that's it. Six times a day. Of course.
So, that's quite dense. So, my question to you is, do you put it into a language that is simpler so that it just goes kind of, do you keep that denseness of the verbal denseness, or do you condense it into, there's a Buddha, that Buddha is me, may that Buddha come in, now I feel that Buddha, I feel the lineage go, or, I'm not trying to paraphrase.
No, I understand, but you've got the essence of it, but that is the essence of it.
So
and
do you say that whole thing, or do you
No.
Your own.
I say the whole thing, although a different translation of it. Say the whole thing. It's actually, it may seem like it's dense, but it's not.
It just is to somebody who's not used to hearing that. Mm-hmm.
But it won't stay dense for you very long. Mm-hmm. It really won't. When you get used to working with the themes, they become not a problem. Mm-hmm. For example, the first line is basically the refuge. At this point, you know what that is. When you're talking about making offerings or homage, you pretty much know what those are. You know how to do those sorts of things. It's not a big thing to sort of imagine. You know, here is the Lama sitting on a lotus visualized in front of you. You can imagine offering him flowers. That's not hard to do. So that's another line. You know what dependent arising is. You know, it's causality. So when you say, it's a guarantee that my good thoughts are going to produce good outcomes, you know why that is, because everything has a consequence. But it's a pithy way of bringing the entire teaching together, starting with refuge, understanding that the Lama is something you're devoted to, not because he's some guy from Amdo, but because he's realized his Buddha nature. And that's what it means to see the Lama in the form of Vajradhara, which is a blue Buddha with consort, who's like sort of the essence, the tantric essence, if you will. So you know that. So you know what each of these things are individually if you stop and think about them. You really do, because we've talked about all of them. And then when you get familiar with kind of the litany, like when you say this, it means this. It's like, oh yeah, I know what this means. Yeah. You know.
And I think that was my question.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, it's not the concepts, it's the litany, it's the way it's being phrased. To me, it seemed sort of, you know, just sort of awkward.
It is.
Yeah. It is.
It is. Jeffrey Hopkins.
Yeah, that's Jeffrey Hopkins'
yeah,
translation.
It's very ponderous and awkward.
Right.
And the other version he's talking about is very poetic and flowing. And if, okay. When it's flowing like that, it makes it much easier
yeah,
to
I'll,
memorize too.
Yeah.
I mean, it just.
I'll recite the one that I do.
Okay.
Okay. But don't interrupt me, or else I'll forget where I am. Just the way it is. Okay. In my heart I turn to the three jewels of refuge. May I free suffering beings and place them in bliss. May the compassionate spirit of love grow within me, that I may complete the enlightening path. In the sky, on a lotus, sun, and moon seat, I see my Lama as Dorje Chang. Blue in color, holding Dorje and Bell, experiencing great bliss with his consort Yin Chukma. On his brow a white om, on his throat a red ah, on his heart a blue hum.
In colors shine out.
Thank you.
Falling forth.
You awaken from all 10 directions. To your blue lotus feet I bow, Dorje Chang. With oceans of clouds I make triple offerings. The land, jewel vase, the sun, the moon, and all precious offerings I present unto you. Now my Lama comes to my head. Oh, I forgot.
Power supreme, powers mundane.
Follow upon pure devotion to you. See, I knew I'd forget it. But okay, so now you've got the idea. It's much more fluid, and I'll dig it up and I'll show it to you. That one's much nicer.
That's
right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't typically recite this out loud with people hanging around, so I kind of lost it.
It happened to me yesterday, too.
Yeah.
The long one.
Yeah.
I forgot a couple times.
Yeah.
It's like learning lines and saying them on stage and just knowing them perfectly, and then having someone say, well, can you say that line that you said, you know, and you're like, oh no, I can't.
Right. And I couldn't remember it, even though I recited every day 6 times. It's like, okay, you know, so.
Thinking it out of context.
Yeah, well, there is that too. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But you get the idea that it's much more fluid, mm-hmm. It's much more visual, but it's the same thing. It is. It's the very same thing. I mean, to your blue lotus feet, I bow, Dorje Chang, is much more fluid than whatever it was that Jeffrey said. Jeffrey's a very great translator. I'm not knocking him when I say this. He's very precise, but as Kay said, a bit ponderous. Okay. But I brought this because I knew if you asked me a question, I'd be going, which was that? Okay, so you have more questions about the Guru Yoga? I'll come back to it another time. Even next time we meet, I'll talk about it some more in relationship to the sadhana generally. But yeah, talk.
Well, what were the three vows again?
The three vows are associated, well, let's see what he says here. three vows have to do with individual liberation, the bodhisattva vows, and the secret mantra vows. And the individual liberation vows are the basic Buddhist vows of the Theravada or the Hinayana, the individual vehicle. They're mostly things like, you know, I'm not going to steal.
Like the Ten Commandments.
Like the Ten Commandments, those kinds of things. Yeah, they're pretty close. The bodhisattva vows are more along the lines of universal altruism and the wish to benefit all beings rather than just take care of yourself. And the secret mantra vows, I can't tell you because they're secret.
They do have to do with the five Buddha families, I can say that much. And the powers that you're, or the negativities that you're trying to transform, and the ones you're trying to develop. So they go along those lines.
Yeah, the vows have to do with specific qualities of practice. But I really can't talk to you about them because they are secret. So if you've had the initiation, I can talk to you about them. But I don't know if you have. You had the initiation in Green Tara?
No.
You have? Oh, then I can talk to you about them. Well, Kay will talk to you about them when she does Green Tara later today.
No, I won't.
No, you won't? Not tonight?
No.
Oh, she's too tired to.
Yeah,
okay, I mean, there are things like the practice of Tantra is mostly about using, not mostly about, one of the features of the practice of Tantra is cultivating non-ordinary appearance, which is to say, not seeing things in the way that ordinary people see things. Okay. For example, theoretically, every time I look at my wife, I'm supposed to see Green Tara. And if I don't see Green Tara sitting here, I've broken my vow. Because I'm seeing an ordinary being sitting here instead of a person who's cultivating Tara within herself. So what I really need to be doing is looking at this as a person who's cultivating Tara within herself rather than this as my mundane wife. Now, that would be breaking the vow, which I obviously then do 24/7. But the intention is to have a different kind of experience of everything in your life. Because Tantra is about transforming everything in your life. The Hinayana vows, or the Theravada vows, pardon me, are about having very simple but positive relations with the people around you. Don't lie, cheat, and steal, that kind of stuff. You know, the basic sort of things that teenagers need to learn. And many people have not learned even when they've grown up. The bodhisattva vows are about understanding our deep interconnected relationships with each other. The tantric vows are about building on that and seeing that the Buddha characteristics within me are the Buddha characteristics within everybody else, and practicing not seeing people as ordinary, but seeing the Buddha nature within everybody and treating everybody as a Buddha. And if you don't do that, then you're breaking your vows.
And hearing all the all of speech as Buddha's voice or mantra, seeing all action as Buddha's activities, it kind of goes along those lines. Seeing your environment as the environment of a Buddha, which we Tantra Mandala Palace.
When you take a shower, you're washing a Buddha. You're not washing yourself.
Yeah.
When you have dinner, you're feeding a Buddha. You're not feeding yourself.
And feeding all beings. It incorporates the Mantrayana. I mean the Mahayana as well. So feeding all beings, not just oneself. So they call it pure view is another way of talking about it.
So the problem, of course, with these kinds of vows is you will break them 24/7 by guarantee. But that's okay. At least it's your intention to make the
it's
attempt.
It's practicing the vows just like everything else.
Yeah. So did that answer the question? Yeah. It's you can look at it and say, my God, what a chore. Or you can look at it and say, wow, what an opportunity. And depending upon which side of the bed I get out of in the morning, it's one or the other, or usually both. I don't mean to make light of it. It's actually quite profound and quite serious, but I speak about it humorously because, you know, there's no point in being sanctimonious and ponderous.
The Japanese talk about, is it Korean, about pure land Buddhism?
What's that about?
Yeah, what is pure land Buddhism compared to what you just talked about in the pure, what was the other term that you used? Pure view.
Pure Land Buddhism is kind of an interesting variation of Guru Yoga, although I don't think you'd ever, in my interpretation, I don't think you'll see that in a book anyplace. What Pure Land Buddhism is about is what arose as a style of Buddhist practice in China, Korea, and Japan, and it was actually the most popular form of Buddhist practice in East Asia, was recognizing that there were great bodhisattvas who'd taken the vow to liberate all beings. I mean, that is the bodhisattva vow. And you're one of those beings that the bodhisattvas took the vow to liberate. So they vowed to liberate you. Isn't that a nice thing? Wouldn't it be nice to say thank you for taking the vow to liberate me, and by the way, here I am, and I want to be in relationship with you, who's taken the vow to liberate me, and I'm going to cultivate that relationship, which is another way of talking about Guru Yoga from some different perspective. And instead of taking the view that, wow, there are these great teachers in these monasteries that I can meet and have a relationship with, they kind of took the view that, well, you know, the great bodhisattvas were beings of the past. There are none of them around now. But they took the vow to liberate me, and they exist outside of time and space, so it's good, and they will, and I can have a relationship with them, because the great bodhisattvas live outside of time and space. They're timeless and spaceless. They exist everywhere at all times, because that's part of what it means to be a bodhisattva. It means to not be constrained by time and space. So you can have a relationship with these great bodhisattvas, and the most typical one that they would have a relationship was Amitabha. And then the issue is, what kind of relationship do you have with them, and how does that work? And the in a certain way, the kind of way that they had relationships with these bodhisattvas would look very similar to what you would find in a good Christian church. I mean, it's kind of unpleasantly shocking to many American Buddhists to discover that there's this whole stream of Buddhism that looks like Christianity. But when you think about what's going on in there, I mean, when I said looks like Christianity, I only mean from the point of view of devotionalism. I don't mean from the point of view of theology, because you could hardly imagine two theologies that are more different. Well, actually, I can. But anyway, that aside, I'm losing track of what I wanted to talk about. So then the question is your relationship with the bodhisattva. And the Japanese developed this idea, because this is a very popular form of Buddhism in Japan, that basically what you need to sort out is, okay, the bodhisattva has taken the vow to liberate me. So that means that my liberation is based upon the power or the activity of the bodhisattva. It's called other power. But if you really think about this, that's great, but you have to do something too. What do you need to do? You need to be paying attention to what's going on, right? So there's the question of own power and other power. The Japanese is tariki and jiriki, but I can never remember which is own power and which is other power. Tariki or the jiriki, but it doesn't make any difference. So what the Japanese understood is you have to make some effort, but it's not enough to get yourself liberated. The bodhisattva makes some effort. It is enough to get yourself liberated. But basically, the two of you have to be working together, and there are all these debates in Japan about, is it really other power or really own power that's at work here? And in a sense, they're obviously both things are going on. It's kind of like one of the lineages that I'm connected with from past practice is that of Ramakrishna, who was a Vedantic saint of mid-19th century in Bengal. And he has all these great little metaphors, and I've often cribbed them, and I didn't tell you. because he was realized, he had this way of saying really profound things using really simple language. It helped that he never went to school. He just realized God. So that made it real simple for him to talk about things in a simple way. He said things like, the wind of the Lord is always blowing, but if you don't raise the sail on your boat, you won't go anywhere. Tariki, jiriki. You got to raise the sail, but God's wind is going to carry you forward. That pretty much says it all as far as I can see. It's really nice to hear these things from people who know what they're talking about, because they can make them like, and you get it, you know. You always know when people don't know what they're talking about because they spend an hour trying to explain something really simple.
I've got a question that I've kind of wondered about for a while, and I think it really pertains to what you're talking about. And I'll let me just say what I think is going on, and let me know if I'm on the right track here. So Buddha is a historical figure, and he attained enlightenment. And then there's somebody like me who feels like, okay, I've practiced some things and I've really learned some things and experienced some things that are really great, and I know I have a lot left to learn and experience if I put my attention in the right place. And so but then somewhere in between, okay, so like the Dalai Lama would probably be the closest approximation to someone like Buddha that is currently living on the face of the earth. And so I guess I'm kind of picturing this continuum with me over here and Buddha way out there and the Dalai Lama pretty close to that end of the scale, and then other teachers along the line in between. Is this...
Sounds right to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And yet I sort of, with the Buddha, I sort of imagine... kind of like a certain point he just sort of left the scale and went out, you know, went over the center field fence and he's gone in a home run kind of thing.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Okay.
But the thing is that as Judeo-Christians, it's very easy, having said that and understood that, to think that he really is outside of the ballpark and I'm in the ballpark. And so, you know, it's kind of like he really is outside of the ballpark. But he's not. We're all in the same ballpark because we're all the same. Because what Shakyamuni realized as his Buddha nature, and therefore became called the Buddha, is absolutely no different than the essence of you. It's no different. And it's, we tend to not remember that. It's easy to forget that. In some cases, we want to forget that. I mean, for example, it's really easy for Kay and I to say, we miss our teacher so much. We want to hang out with him, you know. We want to spend time with him. It's like, oh, we're not going to see him again this year. What a drag, you know. We're moping around for days. When our first teacher died, we went to see the Dalai Lama. And, I mean, our first teacher, when he was dying, said, go see His Holiness to find out what to do next in your spiritual practice. And so we did. It took us a year to organize it, but we did. And one of the things he said was, well, it doesn't matter whether he's alive or not. You have a relationship with him whether he's alive or not. It doesn't matter. And we looked at him like, it doesn't feel that way. You know, but you know, I mean, Locha Rinpoche, our current teacher, would say, doesn't matter whether I'm in Dharamsala or I'm in the room with you. You know, doesn't make any difference. You have a relationship with me, and what you're in relationship with is not over there or over here. It's not dead or alive. It's other.
It's not the personality.
It's not the personality. It's something within there.
But isn't it like when you were talking about missing Kayla? It's there's something about the presence of the other.
Yeah.
That is very, very special.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I mean, what His Holiness told us was a very hard teaching. It was sort of like, yeah, okay, I get it, but I miss him. And I missed him then, and I miss him now.
It's like the touch and the sight. It's the senses part of it, you know?
Yeah.
And being human and being a sense-oriented being and not yet a Buddha.
Yeah. Totally.
We need to touch and smell and see and hear.
Totally, and it's one of the reasons you need to meet a teacher and cultivate that relationship. And then you get to get your heart broken because he dies.
Do you ever, in the meditation that you're talking about, do you ever feel that, like a really strong connection to your teacher?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, there are times when it's like he's in the room. There are times he's in the room.
And it's a two-way relationship.
That's well, relationship. That I don't know.
Well, isn't that a relationship?
Is it? I bet it is.
Well, you'd have to ask him. I don't know. You know, if I went to see him, would he say, oh yeah, I was in the room with you the other day? I mean, he wouldn't tell me that if it were true. That doesn't mean it's not true. It just means he wouldn't tell me that.
I'm not sure I even got
okay,
that.
Maybe I misunderstood what you're saying.
Said you have a relationship with him. Whether he's dead or alive, doesn't relationship mean a two-way communication? And I'm not talking about the, ooh, you know, this person's mm-hmm. talking, but, I mean, mm-hmm. it's the Buddha nature of her tuko is communicating with your Buddha nature, and it's the Buddha nature is the same. It's the same message. So
sounds right to me.
Is that what they mean by relationship?
I think so.
We are the same, so this is our relationship?
I think it is. I think it is. It's just, it would be presumptuous of me to say that because I had a great meditation and I felt that my teacher was there with me, that he would say, yeah, I was there with you. Mm-hmm. That would be incredibly presumptuous of me to say that.
He needs to say that he's always with you.
He would probably not say a word. You know, so my experience of the lamas is we would go to them and we'd say, wow, I had this great experience. And they'd say, yeah, all right, so, yeah, what else? Now let's go talk about something else. They would never talk about this. It drove us crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, they would never talk about, you know. It's like, I remember once we were visiting with Locha Rinpoche and we were sitting on one end, we're sitting in a room in one building in the Green Hotel, and he was in a room in another building in the Green Hotel. And he was doing this ceremony, and I was sitting on the balcony in my room, and I was meditating, and I could hear him, I thought, but there were a lot of voices with a lot of monks going on, and I could kind of feel him, and I could kind of feel him, and it's sort of like we were there together. And then that afternoon I saw him, and I said, wow, Rinpoche, it was really great this morning, you know. I was sitting on the balcony, I could really feel your presence, and so on and so forth. I don't remember what he said, but he didn't say anything about it. He just went on and talked about something else entirely.
It's just like, yeah, of course.
Mm. Aren't the senses part of samsara, our attachment to this sensual atmosphere?
And they're not reinforcing that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's sort of like, well, of course you're feeling my presence. Like, so, what's the big deal? If you weren't, what would you be doing here? Get out of here. You're not my student.
Maybe from It's like you're saying, I put my sail up and I caught the wind, and you're saying, yeah, well, the wind's blowing all the time.
Yeah, so what's the big deal? Thank you. That's exactly it, Brian. Yeah, and I'm saying, wow, I caught the wind. He's saying, hey, schmuck, it's always blowing. Thank you, you're right.
That's perfect.
That's perfect.
And that's, and can I see something about...
Of course.
Yeah, when I told the group yesterday this, but when... Friday, when I saw David Ebel, I was being worked on. He said something about that, you know, like after initiation, that your energy body gets larger. But with that, you know, goes a certain responsibility. So he said, like, you know, can go up like to a half a mile or something. But he goes, and that what that means is that affects everybody within that half a mile, and so that it carries with it a big responsibility. Well, you can imagine what the energy body of these teachers is like. It's just vast, and so that's like the wind. Mm-hmm. It's like the
it is
the neural wind, basically out there. And yeah, and so if you stop and do your guru yoga, that's such a wonderful metaphor, Brian. That's really good between the two of you guys. That's really that's really a perfect way to describe it.
Yeah.
But and they don't want to encourage attachment either, and you know, to any kind of spiritual experience either. Like, if, oh wow, I had this incredible dream, you know, I had this, you know, I had, you know, there was a time at Zen Center when I had this really strong experience in Shoshin, and I went, every teacher I went to was kind of like, you know, they just didn't want to talk about it, they didn't want to encourage me to get attached to that, because it wasn't Buddhahood, so you need to keep going, right, you don't want to stay stuck in one place. But the central part is, it is, you know, there is something about being closer to them, like in the proximity. Mm-hmm. Maybe the wind's stronger. I mean, I don't know how to talk about it.
Makes sense to me.
It does tend to, it feels like it speeds things up. It burns away, perhaps helps you burn away old karma, helps you move through obstacles, helps in your own, you know, being in your own life in some way that's hard to understand.
Ride the winds with Dalai Lama, even if you don't understand it. Mm-hmm.
That was my advice.
Because that first day was so hard. Yeah. But, you know, just being in his presence was just like,
right.
It was, you know, I couldn't have imagined that
right.
at all, ever.
You have to meet it. But having met it, you can remember it and cultivate it. And I do think that in a certain way, one of the reasons that they don't hang around a lot, and I don't mean as in die, I mean that they don't hang around a lot, is that it's too easy to just say, wow, I'm taking a bath in this, and just not do anything else. And if they're not around, then you know, you have to really work at it. You have to raise the sail and get in the right position and, you know, work the tiller and all that kind of stuff, rather than just sort of like, ah, it's so nice here, you know? And it is so nice here, you know, and I personally believe that every once in a while you've got to go there and reconnect with it at a certain level and get a taste of it again, so that you don't lose track of it and don't, you know, sort of drift into something that's not. It's sort of like cooking, I guess. You know, you want to get the seasonings right. And it's easy to get the seasonings a little bit wrong. So it's sort of like you go to where the you go to where the seasonings are right. Yeah, like yesterday, too much cumin. I had to throw out all that water and start all over again, or else it would have been awful soup.
So was Shakyamuni Buddha a historic person who attained enlightenment?
Most people think so. There's some people who would really say that if you really look at the evidence, you can't even prove that he existed. Okay. But, you know, except for Muhammad, they say that about everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing about Shakyamuni is that at the time that he existed, there was no writing. So everything that he said was remembered and passed on orally. And whenever that's the case, then it's possible for scholars to look at that and say, well, what do we really know for sure? You know, it's like at one point, I'll give a different example, which is Jesus. Because the whole issue of whether or not Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha existed or not, it was taken for granted that he did up until recently. And now scholars are saying, well, you know, if you really look through all the scriptures, it would be really hard to prove that he really did exist. Although I think most scholars would say, but yeah, he did. I mean, you know, who he was, what he did, what he really said is maybe a little bit more complicated. But if, you know, you push them, you really push their analytic, scholarly chops, they'll say, well, we can't really totally be sure. So, I mean, but what happened in regards to Jesus, and this will probably happen at some time in regards to Shakyamuni also, what happened in regards to Jesus was some point starting, I don't know if it was in the late 70s or the early 80s, a bunch of scholars got together in something called the Jesus Seminar. I don't know if you've heard of this or not. But there were people who knew all the ancient languages that were relevant. And they looked at all the examples of all the old scriptures, and they read the original languages, and they looked at things, and they compared things, and they looked at all the translations, and they said, okay, time for a vote. How many people say this line is really what he said? And, you know, there might be, I don't know how many there were, 60 or 80 or however many there were. And some group of them said yes, and some of them said no. Okay. So, we you know, if there were 100 of them and 60 said yes and 40 said no, then there's a 60% chance he said it. I'm going to make it simple. And they went through everything in the Gospels like that. And when they got finished, there was a limited amount that they said, yep, he said it. And it was real short. It was real short. Now, they'll probably do that with Shakyamuni at some point. I mean, because there are not that many Western scholars that are concerned with Buddhism to really be able to do that. There are not that many people that have enough of the languages and so on and so forth.
What about the ashes? That they took and built stupas all over.
Well, they could be in. If you're a scholar, you'd say they could be anybody's ashes.
Okay.
Anybody could be in there. That could be anybody's bone fragment. I suppose if you could do DNA tests and you found that all the bone fragments have the same DNA in all these different stupas, then you might be able to triangulate on the fact that that was the case. But I don't expect that they're going to get permission to do DNA tests on bone fragments that come out of stupas.
Sometimes you just have to look.
Yeah, I don't think it really matters. There used to be a thing about in the early part of the 20th century, there was a movement to figure out what the original teachings of the Buddha were, which is something similar, but there weren't enough people who had enough languages to do like the Jesus Seminar kind of thing. So they tried to figure out what the original teachings of the Buddha were, and some people said this is it and that's not it. But the problem with that is, if you actually know how teaching is done in a spiritual tradition, you realize that these guys are off the mark. So I'll go back to Ramakrishna again, and then maybe we'll call it quits with this. So the thing that's interesting about Ramakrishna is he had a student called Mahendranath, M is the way he's usually referred to, who was a school teacher. And he took copious notes. He would go to Ramakrishna's teachings, and he'd make a couple notes, and then he'd go home and he'd write out the notes. And he did this for years. So it's one of those rare cases where we have somebody who actually spent time with what the Indians consider a total realized God-man saint person, which I totally buy that he was. And so M took notes of all of his teachings. And if you look at his notes, and they're the fat books of English translations from the Bengali, so you look at the notes that he took, and what you find is really interesting. So M would be sitting with him when he'd be with his monastic disciples, and he'd be teaching one kind of thing. And M would be with him when the housewives would show up, he'd be teaching a whole other kind of thing. And M would be with him when the playwrights would show up. He'd be teaching a whole other kind of thing. And then the yogis would show up and he'd teach a whole other kind of thing, you know, and so on and so forth. So basically it was kind of like, well, these seem like totally different teachings if you look at them, you know. You'd tell the playwright, yeah, it's okay to drink alcohol, just remember God when you're drunk. And to the monks he'd say, alcohol, don't go near it, it's bad for your practice. You know, it's like, the housewives would show up and he'd say, oh, imagine God is like your husband and bow down to him the way you bow down to your husband. I mean, you know, this is 19th century Bengal, right? You know? And then the yogis would show up and he'd say things like, God is within you and bow to no one else unless you see God within them or something like that. It's like totally nuanced teachings for the audience. So the guys who were looking, because they were, the scholars were mostly guys anyway, the scholars who were looking for what was original Buddhism said, well, this is the original Buddhism, but they kind of ignored the fact that there are all sorts of other traditions that didn't necessarily get written down in certain ways that got written down later in other kinds of ways and went through other lines of transmission, but didn't necessarily go through a monastic line of transmission or didn't go to a certain country at a certain time.
And
so,
there were those scholars that got together in the caves that we went to visit, right?
Well, that was a little different. Yeah, after
they did the same thing. They decided what was actual words and what weren't.
Yeah, well, what Kay is saying is after the Buddha's death, okay, so I was going to stop, but since you've raised that, okay. After the Buddha's death, his disciples got together and said, well, you know, I guess we're going to have to carry this tradition on. So, I guess one of the things we have to do now is we have to agree upon what it was that he taught. Because there, you know, within a few years of the Buddha's death, there are already people walking around and said the Buddha said such and such a thing, and other people would say, I spent 30 years with him. I never heard him say that. That doesn't sound right to me, you know. So the scholar, the disciples, the oldest and the direct disciples of the Buddha got together in a cave, which we visited. And they had great memories, and one of them in particular, Ananda, which was very close to the Buddha, said, okay, I'm going to tell you everything I remember him saying. And he went on day after day after day. When we were in Visali, in the rains of such and such a time, the Buddha was in such and such a place, and someone came from this other place and asked him this question. And then this is what he said in response to that. And so when you read the sutras, the actual sutras start out by saying, the Buddha was in such and such a place, thus I have heard. The Buddha was in such and such a place and such a time, and somebody showed up and asked a question, and this was his answer. Almost all of them were like that. So Ananda would say these things, and Ananda was with him all the time. He was like his attendant, very close to him. And then he would say, so this happened at this place at this time, he taught this thing. And then everybody around said, yeah, I was there, I remember that. Or, yeah, that sounds like something he would say. Okay, that's for sure, that's real, we know that. You know. And then somebody else would say, well, you know, I was on Vulture Peak with him in, you know, in the such and such a time, and this merchant came along and had this question, and the Buddha said thus and such a thing. And everybody said, that doesn't sound right. I wasn't there. Are you sure about that? Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Well, nobody else heard anything like that. That doesn't sound right. That one's out. Well, that one's out. What does that mean? Well, maybe he really did say it, you know. And then that person said it to somebody else who said it to somebody else who said it to somebody else. And then later in the tradition, people looked at it and said, well, yeah, that really is right, but that's a special teaching for a special kind of person. So now it's back in. And then the scholars look at that and say, the 20th century scholars look at that and say, well, that doesn't sound right because it was back in 300 years after the Buddha died, so it can't be original. Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on how you look at things.
No wonder the Mormons created somebody in the new century.
Later day saint?
Because, I mean, you know, they wanted somebody that was talking to them right now. I could just see that. Mm-hmm. You know,
or at all.
Yeah. Someone, or you know, someone like Joseph Smith, wow, it's someone we can talk to right now instead of trying to figure out what is right, what is not right, because of all the different books of Jesus and all the different translations and the Gnostic Gospels being left out and found in the 50s, and then they came out back out in the 70s, and they're all about the women and the mother, you know, son, father, mother. I mean, you know, it's like, geez, please just give me someone that now, you know, it's closer.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of understand in a very
different
way.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they left the women out again.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about Buddhism is every couple of hundred years. I mean, when you look at it closely, you see that every couple hundred years, you know, there's something new going on. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Well, because every couple hundred years, human beings are different enough that the old message has to get converted into something that works for the current times. I mean, if you listen to the way the Dalai Lama teaches, right, he doesn't teach like anybody in the 19th century taught.
Mm-hmm. Good news.
Good news. Yeah, well, good news. You know, I mean, he says stuff like, here's Buddhism, here's science. If science says this and Buddhism says that and they're in conflict, then we know by subjecting to the scientific truths to good test, they're right. Throw out what the Buddhists say. Wow. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, okay. But it's very important to look at what he's saying, because he's saying, you know, if you subject the scientific analysis to close scrutiny, it has to hold up, right? So the scientific analysis of things that science can't study doesn't hold up. And there are many things that Buddhists are interested in that science can't go near because you can't apply the scientific method to it. So that stuff's not going to get thrown out until you figure out how to apply the scientific method to it. But if you can, okay. I mean, for example, in Buddhist cosmology, there's Mount Meru in the center, four continents around it, and that's reality. Well, you know, Dalai Lama says to his very conservative monks, hey guys, science tells us that here's the sun, here's the earth, here are the planets, they go around, and then here's the solar system doing this, and it's floating around in the galaxy, and there are all these galaxies. They didn't see any mountain any place, and there are more than four continents. So throw out that thing, even if it's in the scripture, because it's been disproved by science. And, you know, the old monk saying, okay, well, you're the Dalai Lama. Okay. Yeah, yeah. You're the Dalai Lama, so in public we'll throw it out, but in private we're going to believe it. You know, I mean, that kind of thing. But he does. He says that. So we've got to stop someplace. Let's stop there.
So can we request a copy of your...